Coming up on Path to Zero.
All of us need to become climate activists, you know, in our personal choices, in our daily lives, in the way we vote, in the way we interact, in the way we talk about, you know, climate change with other people. We need all hands on board.
Welcome to a special edition of Path to Zero, recorded from the Reuters Global Energy Transition Summit in New York City. Now, here's your host, Tucker Perkins.
Do you ever think about what you can do on a daily basis to reduce your carbon footprint? We're going to find out in this episode from award-winning journalist Eduardo Garcia. He's a renewable energy reporter for Reuters and the author of the book, Things You Can Do, How to Fight Climate Change and Reduce Waste. Eduardo, it's so nice to have you here in New York and on the Path to Zero. Thanks for being with us.
Likewise, thanks for having me.
We've got a lot to cover, but let's start with you. 8 years in Latin America with Reuters, now on renewable energy. Talk to us about how you got started and maybe what you've been covering for the last years.
When I first moved to Latin America, I was in my mid-20s. I started with the Reuters News Agency in Guatemala, and then I was there for about 3 years. Then I went to Bolivia, where I lived for about 4 years. From then, the agency sent me to Argentina for a couple of years, and finally Ecuador for a couple of years. I got a very good overview of the whole region, very comprehensive, I would say. And I report about all kinds of things, you know, and politics, natural resources, sometimes violence, sometimes like cocaine trafficking. And then I moved to New York back in 2015 and started writing about the capital markets for about a couple of years. And then I decided to follow my passion. I wanted to specialize on environmental reporting. And that led me into about a seven-year journey. I went back to school. I studied an MA at Columbia Journalism School on science and climate and medicine reporting for a couple of years. And then I started like freelancing and becoming what I, you know, describe myself as a climate reporter.
What an awesome career. And you really went back and retrained to report on the climate.
That's right. I thought I needed that, you know, and I think one of the strengths of that MA that I studied at Columbia was that it was very science focused. And, you know, Columbia Journalism School is a great school. We were very privileged to have amazing professors. And very often we had like guests who give us like lectures. We had like a couple of Nobel Prize winners. And so it was a very good insight into science, you know, and climate science in particular, and writing about science, which is like different. It's a different skill set, basically, that I acquired by being there, you know. And then after I finished my MA, I did a fellowship at Columbia Journalism School as well. And it's called an investigative reporting fellowship. So I spent another year there doing investigative reporting and publishing a few stories that were actually published in The Guardian and Slate that were more like in-depth and, you know, so I was saying earlier, investigative.
Well, what a great start to what will still be a great career ahead of you. First book, right? You've written your first book.
Part of my freelance climate change career has been was freelancing for the New York Times, which I did for about 3 years. So I wrote, I think it's a couple of dozen stories for the New York Times. And those stories were about the carbon footprint and about individual action to fight the climate crisis. So in general, it's about the kind of things that we can do in our daily lives to have live more sustainably and also lower our environmental footprint. And those stories kind of like changed the way that I live, to put it somehow. I became more sustainable myself. I became very passionate about trying to reduce the amount of plastic waste that I generate, or, you know, I became pretty much like vegetarian. And I started living much more sustainably. And, you know, after kind of freelancing for the New York Times for about 2 or 3 years, I had that wealth of knowledge that I wanted to turn into a book. And that's how Things You Can Do, how to fight climate change and reduce waste came to be.
That's a wonderful story. You'd be the first person that we really talked to that is personally chosen to maybe live life differently. So maybe talk about it from your own personal perspective. What are some of the things you're doing or that you think everyone should do? Do you turn down your thermostat in the summer or in the winter and turn it up in the summer? Or is that one thing you do?
Sure, I would say I go farther than that. I mean, I don't have an AC. I've never had one in New York, so I deal with the heat without actually using you know, pretty much any power. I use fans at home, and I try to, you know, keep the windows open, use curtains to keep the block the sun from coming to my place, you know, try to not use the oven during the day, that will heat up my place. So I do, I'm very conscientious about the amount of energy that I use at home, especially the AC and the heating in the winter. Those two things, like cooling and heating your place, are the things that need the most energy. So I'm very aware of that. And I think that, you know, there are many ways in which you can live more, you know, like a more environmentally friendly lifestyle, or more, you know, sustainably, basically. And I think the book covers, you know, all the areas, just basically like, you know, how you can reduce energy at home, what you can do in terms of transportation, waste, try to reduce especially plastic waste, and then food is a key one as well. About a third of greenhouse gas emissions come from agriculture and food production. So that's a very important aspect. I would say that probably that's the one that I've changed the most over the past few years, you know, like following this route of, you know, trying not to eat any meat and becoming, you know, pretty much vegetarian. I do eat fish on occasion, but, you know, I mostly eat a plant-based diet.
And you do that because you've realized through your years that generally animals, chickens, pigs, beef, difficult to raise in a sustainable way, CO2 emissions. Is that pretty much why you do that?
Definitely. I think there are two things. One of them is definitely what you just described, which is the environmental footprint. And I think it's very important to highlight there that part of that environmental footprint of meat production is the feeding, you know. About a third of all the agricultural land that we have in the world is right now being used to produce animal feed. So, you know, it's important to highlight that, you know, because I think that a lot of people talk about carbon emissions, but it's a very big aspect of deforestation, you know, especially in the Amazon and you know, I mean, in many other countries too. I mean, trees being cut down to make, you know, area for agriculture and to grow food. And very often that food is actually being fed to animals, you know. So that's an important aspect. But then there's another aspect as well, which I think is, you know, I mean, becoming vegetarian or eating a plant-based diet is so much more healthier, you know. Mm-hmm. I've definitely lost weight. I feel I have more energy, you know, and I think in the long term has a lot of positive effects on my personal health. So, you know, I think it's very important to highlight that as well.
So let's kind of branch from that. You write for the climate. You realize how important it is to live your personal life in a way that benefits the climate, but you also see now how important it is for your own personal health. So for the first time, you're a guest that really begins to prioritize health and climate. Do you feel like in this conversation that we're having around specifically greenhouse gases, that we often understate the importance of doing things that promote good health? I think about diesel emissions and the horrific emissions relative to our health. NOx emissions, bad for our lungs, particulate matter, bad for our bodies. So do you think that the current world, we overstate the importance of greenhouse gases and understate the importance of emissions that impact our health?
I don't know. That's a difficult question. I would say that we probably underestimate both. I mean, I don't think that we are like fully comprehend a lot of the aspects of that have to do with greenhouse gas emissions, especially when it comes to, like, you know, I think we understand CO2 better, but I think, you know, gases like methane, we don't have such a good understanding, you know, or we don't have as much of an awareness, you know. I mean, I think a lot of people don't understand that methane is also greenhouse gas, and it's about 80 times as powerful when it comes to its greenhouse gas effect than CO2, you know. It lasts less in the atmosphere, but its impacts are huge. And, you know, one of the main sources of greenhouse gas, of methane emissions, is actually food waste. So, you know, there's an organization called the Drawdown Project, which actually investigates climate solutions, and they list, like, food waste very high in their ranking, because food waste produces a lot of methane. Methane actually has a much more greenhouse gas effect than CO2. And I think a lot of people are not very in tune with that. They're not very aware of how important it is, you know. Right. A lot of methane emissions come from, you know, natural gas and oil extraction as well. And that's, you know, the International Energy Agency describes methane emissions as a low-hanging fruit in the fight against climate change, because we could do so much more. It would be so relatively easy for us to actually reduce methane emissions, and it's just not happening.
Do you think it's not happening in the U.S. or not happening in the world, or just not happening?
I think it's not happening fast enough. I think it's definitely not happening, you know, in the U.S. in a large scale. I don't think there's enough pressure on fossil fuel companies to cut down on their methane emissions. I think a lot more could be done in the U.S. In Russia as well. If I remember correctly, Russia is, you know, the top three methane emitters, and that's, you know, I mean, it's kind of harder to put pressure on Russia to actually do that, you know, and I think some Arab countries are actually doing a better work when it comes to methane emissions. Yeah.
One last thing about the book, and we'll try to refer to it because it's wonderfully written and really one of the few books that does specifically address how individuals can and should act. It's beautifully illustrated by Sarah Boccaccini Meadows, right? Was she a friend of yours? How did you come to get her to be such a wonderful partner to you in this book?
So the idea for the book from the very, very beginning was that I wanted to do an illustrated book. I thought an illustrated book was a way of like drawing people in. I always say that things you can do is a book for someone who will never read a climate change book. And the idea of using illustrations was to getting a new public, you know, that wouldn't normally buy a book about climate change. So I knew that I wanted to do an illustrated book, and I knew that I needed to find someone that I could partner with in a long-term project. And that was challenging, you know, to start with. And I knew I wanted to work with a woman. I didn't want it to be, you know, a white dude telling people what to do, you know, so it was very important for me to team up with a woman. Through my experience as a journalist covering climate solutions, I actually come to realize that a lot of people in the sustainability movement are actually women. I think women are living this fight, for sure. I have no doubt about that. So that was why I wanted the illustrator that I was going to work with to be a woman. So what do you do when you want to find a female illustrator? You go online, and it's actually a website called Women Who Draw, which is a catalog of female illustrators. And I just went there. There's probably dozens. I mean, there might be hundreds of female illustrators there. They're listed. You know, basically, it's a picture of them, a picture of their style and their artwork. And you can just go and basically look at that. And I knew that I wanted to work with someone who was based in New York because, you know, I knew this is a very personal project. I knew I wanted to be work like shoulder to shoulder kind of thing with someone, like, you know, meet and talk and discuss. And that's how I found Sarah. I really like her style. I thought her illustrations are beautiful. And I knew that she was based in New York. So I reached out to her through that website. And, you know, from the very first day, she was up for it. So the first part of the project was actually to put together a proposal for my agent. I already had an agent at the time, and the agent then, you know, sent a proposal to a number of publishers, and Sarah was on board. And you know, when we started talking about the projects, it was like during the very early days of the pandemic. So I thought that Sarah and I were gonna work shoulder to shoulder, as I was telling you earlier, but then the pandemic happened basically, and she moved to the UK for a few months and then to LA. So we ended up like working, you know, remotely and teaming up, like, you know, communicating via WhatsApp and email instead of, you know, being in the same place. But, you know, by that time we already had met a number of times and we were already familiar with one another. We were in very friendly terms, and it was a great, great collaboration. And I'm really happy that I teamed up with her. And, you know, after putting together the book, we done a number of promotional events in like libraries and cultural centers, and it's been really nice to team up with her for those events. And you know, since the publication of the book, we became friends as well, and we, you know, we hung out.
Well, beautifully written and beautifully illustrated. Great job for that. Talk about one last thing, and then I want to get to your coverage around wind. But you know, as we talk to people, I think one thing we see and read about is individuals fall into, I think, several camps. The problem of climate change is so immense, they don't understand it. They may not even be interested in it. So one is getting individuals even to become aware. And there really is the other extreme. Individuals that are aware of it realize it's probably out of their individual control and it gives them great anxiety. How do you speak to both groups? To those who don't even seem to care and those who care so much, it really causes them harm.
That's a very difficult question to answer and something that I struggle with in my own mind, and I debate continuously with friends and other activists as well. I think that, you know, this debate between individual and collective action is not an either or choice. I think we need both of them, you know. One of my favorite climate scientists his name is Peter Kalmus. He works for NASA and he's also an activist. And he says that we need 1 billion climate activists. And I really like that concept, you know, because I think we need to basically bring everybody on board, you know. And I think the key to do that very often is to start with this, you know, with sustainability and these small changes, go step by step, you know what I mean? And these things might look small, you know, but what I've learned through my career, my activism, is that people start this way and then they become much more involved in their community. They start being much more conscientious when they vote, and they vote to, like, you know, like pro-climate politicians and leaders, you know. They become, you know, they go to protest, they become activists themselves, you know, and I think that's key. But as we were discussing earlier as well, I think it's very important that it's healthier. That lifestyle is actually going to make you, you know, healthier, but it's also going to help the environment. So I think it's a win-win situation, you know. Today, the GEL Climate Communications Program published a survey saying that, you know, only about 30% of U.S. voters are pro-climate voters. I was shocked about that number. You know, it's actually very low. It's only about a third of the U.S. Voting population, you know. So I think it's very important to activate people, you know, and I think that we need to, all of us need to become climate activists, you know, in our personal choices, in our daily lives, in the way we vote, in the way we interact, in the way we talk about, you know, climate change with other people. We need all hands on board.
I think one of the keys to feeling less anxious about it is, in fact, to realize there are things you can do. Take the bus instead of drive, walk instead of drive. As you say, have less food waste, conserve energy and water. By just doing those actions, you can feel engaged and, I would think, feel more connected.
I agree 100%, yeah. I think those may look like small things. They're also big things. So, I mean, look at car ownership, for instance, you know. I mean, in the U.S., cars are bigger than in other countries because most people prefer to buy SUVs and pickup trucks. Those cars on average issue about, like, you know, 20-30% more CO2 than what you would call like a standard size car in Europe, you know. According to the International Energy Agency, I mean, SUVs and bigger cars are actually the second driver in the increase of CO2 emissions that we've seen in recent years. So it's not a small thing. It's actually a big thing. It makes a difference. It can help make a difference for sure.
Right. All right, let's move to wind. And you've written a lot about wind, and I think wind over the last couple of years has probably really had a bit of a black eye. A lot of projects offshore pulled back for economic reasons. And even onshore wind, you know, is coming off of a relatively bad year where the wind didn't blow quite as much. So even all the wind we built, we didn't produce as much wind energy in 2023 as we did in 2022. What do you think is the future? And let's break it down into two buckets. What do you think is the future of wind onshore? Do you see it continuing to grow, or do you see it at a difficult inflection point?
I think it's picking up. I think we are crossing that inflection point, and wind installations are going to start increasing this year and next. I don't think it's going to be as fast as many people hope. I think the onshore wind industry faces a number of challenges. One of them is the supply chain challenge. You know, it's a number of the leading wind turbine makers have had quality issues that they need to focus on, and they need to increase production. They need to really scale manufacturing capacity, especially in the US, you know? And that takes time. You need to build factories, you need to put them together, you need to train people, you know? So I think that's a challenge that in the US, in part thanks to the Inflation Reduction Act, we're gonna see an improvement, but it's gonna take time. Another challenge that the onshore wind industry is facing is that many of the best sites, you know, the best areas, especially in the Midwest, are already kind of a little bit overloaded, you know? So the most productive areas already have a lot of like wind installations. So, you know, investors need to find new places where they can actually build their wind projects. And sometimes they find hostility in local communities. You know, some people don't like seeing wind turbines, you know? In the US, our previous president, Donald Trump, was very critical of the wind industry. You know, he publicly said that wind turbines produce cancer, which is false. And that turned a lot of people off, from wind installations. And it's also true that maybe visually, you know, wind installations onshore have a bigger impact, you know, and people don't want to see them near their homes. And that's why in the US we have this so-called not in my backyard movement, where a lot of communities are actually opposing onshore wind. But at the end of the day, it's a much cleaner energy and much more efficient than producing power with fossil fuels.
Right. How about offshore wind?
Offshore wind is facing more challenges because it's a new industry. Okay. So, you know, the US has been building onshore wind for many years. We know that it's very effective. We need to produce a lot of power. We have very, very good wind resources. Offshore wind is a nascent industry in the US. And whenever you do something from scratch, you know, it's always more challenging, right? So there's a number of projects. The Biden administration right now has a target of building 30 gigawatts of offshore wind energy by 2030. That's a very ambitious target. And we have about a dozen offshore wind projects in the East Coast right now, and a number of foreign investors, particularly European companies that are investing in offshore wind in the East Coast. It's happening. It's moving slowly. It's moving slower than many people anticipated because a lot of supply chain challenges as well. So, you know, this wind turbines are much bigger. Right now in the US, there's not such a thing as a manufacturing industry for offshore wind turbines. So those need to be produced in Europe, brought over here, or we need to build that new manufacturing capacity from scratch. And again, those are very, very, very big investments. You know, if you're going to be an investor and you're going to build a manufacturing plant here in New York to produce offshore wind turbines, you need to be very, very sure that you're going to have demand in the long term, not from one day to the next, but in the next 10, 20 years. So the industry is being built up. I think, as I was saying earlier, it's slower than, you know, many people in the industry anticipated, but it's happening. And we need offshore wind to decarbonize the power sector. And the reason for that is that, you know, offshore wind turbines are much more powerful and the wind offshore is much more constant. And, you know, one of the good things about it as well is that a lot of the, you know, the areas in the East Coast that demand the most power, you know, New Jersey, New York, Massachusetts, are very close to very good offshore wind resources. So you don't need that much build that much transmission, you know what I mean? Because the power source is right there and the urban centers are right there. So, you know, that's beneficial.
Yeah. Interesting. You know, you strike me as a person who's very thoughtful about the whole system, and you also strike me as a person very committed to solar and wind. Let's just focus with wind for a second. Wind would say to have a pretty negative impact on bird population onshore, particularly eagles seem to be a problem. And then one of the knocks on even offshore wind is generally in areas where the ecosystems are pretty delicate, perhaps having an impact on right whales and some other endangered or nearly endangered species. As you report on it and study these things from yourself, do you feel like those concerns are overhyped, adequately balanced? How do you feel about the sighting of this of wind onshore or off and its damage to the environment?
Every form of energy production is going to have some kind of environmental impact. renewable energy has a much lesser environmental impact compared to fossil fuels. That's the bottom line. There's no discussion about that. But very often the problem is that fossil fuel extraction happens very far away from us. So we don't see, you know, as I was saying before, it's not in our backyard. So I do understand that people, you know, are worried about these environmental impacts. As someone who, you know, loves nature myself and also concerned, you know, but these companies are doing very thorough environmental studies before they build their projects. And I think, you know, I trust that those are actually reliable and they measure the impact and they try to minimize the impact. It's never going to go down to zero because, you know, everything we do has some kind of environmental impact. But on a personal level, I'm confident that offshore wind energy is much better for the environment, much better for whales, much better for eagles, and much better for all marine species than fossil fuel extraction. There's no doubt about it. Another aspect of that question that I think sometimes upsets me is that people talk about eagles because eagles are so beautiful and they're a symbol of, you know, freedom in the United States. But wind turbines have a much bigger impact on bat populations. I mean, you know, environmentalists worry much more about bats than they worry about birds when it comes to wind turbines. And it's an aspect that sometimes, like, you know, these people who oppose wind turbines fail to mention. You know, no one is saying, hey, they're killing bats, but they're killing more bats than they kill birds.
Bats are horribly misunderstood, aren't they?
You know, they are. I think they have a very bad press, unfortunately. But I would be more worried about bats than birds, you know, if I were an environmentalist.
Yeah, but you make a powerful statement that every form of energy has some negative consequence. And it's interesting to me that you find balance in that. That's good. Let me talk about an article that I read when you wrote it, even before I knew you'd be with us on Path to Zero, where you were talking about particularly offshore wind. You know, we've been in this period where the blades got bigger and bigger and the output got higher and higher. But now it feels like, at least temporarily, we've reached kind of the biggest. In fact, they've kind of scaled back now, so we're making them a bit smaller. You think that's where we stay, or do you think we're at a pause in technology and eventually we'll figure out how to get more kilowatts out of a wind turbine?
And this is the eternal question. I mean, that size matters, you know. It does to a certain extent, but I think that, you know, turbines are actually getting too big. And the problem with that is that, you know, every time a developer actually builds a new turbine that is bigger than the previous one, they need to build new manufacturing capacity to actually produce that new turbine, you know? Yeah. And there's a risk because they have to develop bigger and bigger turbines in very short periods of time. And that leads to quality issues with bigger turbines, you know? So, you know, and from my point of view, and a lot of experts agree with this from my personal point of view, and I think a lot of experts in industry agree with me, it's just better to stop that, you know, race for bigger turbines. What we need to do is to standardize production so we can produce more turbines of the same size in a kind of like a standardized way. And in the long term, that would probably help accelerate construction of both onshore and offshore wind turbines if we were for now to actually stop that race and, you know, focus on just the turbines that we have. That are, I think they're good enough for now.
Yeah. I'm gonna free you now to think just in your role almost uniquely as not only just a climate reporter, but one specifically trained. You've seen a lot of the European way, you've seen the Latin America way, you've been in America a long time. Any stories that are that need to be told that aren't being told, or anything about innovation or how we're moving towards a just transition, a story that needs to be told, not being told?
I think there are many. I think, you know, when it comes to food, for instance, I think like moving to a plant-based diet and getting more people on board with that will be very effective in the fight against climate change and to, you know, try to decarbonize food production. I think that would be very important. I think we need more focus on that, you know. I also think that, like, you know, when it comes to urban centers, decarbonizing transportation, getting people on bikes, building more public transportation is key as well, instead of like moving to electric vehicles. I think there needs to be a stronger emphasis on electric trains and public transportation to decarbonize urban centers. I would say that, you know, those two aspects are really important and don't get enough coverage for sure. Another one is climate education. You know, I think we need to learn more. We need to know more about climate, especially, you know, young adults and kids. You know, they need to learn about the climate solutions that they can implement in their daily lives, but also, you know, how to, you know, get society to move to a cleaner and better future for everybody, really.
I want to get to the magic wand, but everything you say prompts me to just throw in one more. You talk about we need to have access to electric cars, perhaps think about electric trains. Do you think we need to be more transparent about whether the electricity we use is clean or how it's made? Or do you just trust the people that make electricity that they'll make it as clean as possible?
I think we need to be more aware about where electricity comes from. I think, you know, a lot of people are not aware that actually fossil fuels are being burned to produce power. In general, you know, more transparency is always good. You know, utilities and power companies should be more transparent about where they source their power from, you know. And I think people should also seek that information more, you know. I mean, one of the problems that we're facing now as well is that at the same time that we're trying to decarbonize the power sector, power demand is increasing. So that's making the challenging much more and more difficult. So I think one of the very big aspects that sometimes we tend to ignore is that we need to lower energy consumption if we can, in any way, at a personal level and a society level as well, you know. It will help, you know, as much to transition to renewables as actually trying to reduce energy consumption in whatever way we can.
Yes, well said. All right, let's hand you that magic wand. With that wand, you get to use it one time for one thing in the next year that will have the biggest impact on climate change. How would you use it, Eduardo?
If I had to choose just one thing, you know, it's 2024, we're gonna have an election in November, and we have two candidates that are head-to-head, you know, Donald Trump and Joe Biden. Joe Biden, during his administration, passed the Inflation Reduction Act. It's probably the biggest piece of legislation to fight the climate crisis that has ever been passed in the U.S. However, Donald Trump has a reputation of being against renewable energy. He pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord when he was president. So I think, you know, I would say that we need people in power that are pro-climate and pro-renewable energy. And I would like to see those people in office come in November 2024.
Good answer. Thank you very much. All right, National Forest. We love to plant a tree in a national forest in your name, really with respect for the time, the expertise you share with us today. Where would you like to see that tree planted?
Well, a few weeks ago, I was in the Pacific Northwest for the first time. I went to the Olympic National Park. I thought it was beautiful. I saw the Northern Lights for the first time. Again, amazing. There's a lot of beautiful trees there, you know, and I think that's a place where I would love to see a tree, or my tree, you know. But also, you know, California is now being hit by massive wildfires. There are cities and towns that have actually been hit by wildfires in the past few years. And I think those areas are probably, you know, more in need than the Pacific Northwest. So I would say I'd probably go to somewhere in California that has been hit by a wildfire.
An impacted area by wildfires in California.
That's right.
We'll work to that goal. All right, the softball for a reporter. What have I not asked you that you would like to tell our listeners?
I think we covered this during our conversation, but I would like to highlight that we all need to be on board. We all need to do something to fight the climate crisis. The climate crisis is the worst thing that humanity has ever faced. We need to be more aware and better informed, and we need to do something, whatever it is that you can do in your personal life as a voter, as a family person, as a consumer. Anything, you know, just become more aware and try to be more proactive when it comes to fighting the climate crisis.
Eduardo Garcia, reporter for Reuters, living the personal words you write. Love talking about your book, Things You Can Do. And I appreciate your time with us today on Path to Zero.
Thank you. Thanks for having us. It's a great conversation.
Thank you for listening to a special edition of Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to pathtozero@propane.com.